Well, I do apologize because there have been a couple of speaking schedules that have been circulating. One was revised, and I'm not sure which one I was working off of, but I prepared a Bible study, and Asa prepared a sermonette. So you're getting both of those sandwiched around each side of the sermon today, since we both prepared and are ready to go today. I took about 32 scriptures out of my sermon, so it should be a little shorter for your convenience this afternoon. I think that's how many scriptures I had in my first sermon that I ever gave, but I use a lot less now. Well, I don't know about you, but I have been very interested in the Olympics this past week, and I've watched probably more television in the last week than I've watched in the previous 3 months. Our guests from Japan were very interested in the Olympics because there were a number of Japanese athletes involved. And I don't know, I can't help but just admire not just the natural talent that some people have, but also the hard work that they put in to prepare for the Olympics. It is amazing. And of course, there are some outstanding athletes that many of us saw and witnessed if you watched the Olympics. They occur only once every 4 years, as we know. And so with my background in track and field in high school and college, I'm intensely interested, especially in the track and field events. But there are other events that capture the American heart during this Summer Olympics, like gymnastics, which are, I don't know if you've ever met a gymnast, one of those gymnasts that are Olympic champions, but they're only about that tall. You know, they're real small, petite people, but boy, can they perform. That captures our hearts. Diving is especially, I think, captivating in the minds of many. But I lean towards the track and field events, and you cannot help but admire a great athlete like the Jamaican Usain Bolt, who's now dubbed the fastest man in the world, who can run the 100 and the 200, and he holds the world record in both of those. Did not break it during the Olympic Games, but won the gold medal. In fact, he won 9 gold medals during these Olympics, which ties him with, you know, Carl Lewis and some of the very great athletes over the last 30 years that have competed in track and field. Outstanding athlete. And when you see him run against other highly trained athletes, you go, wow. And he beats them, you know, by several yards. He is a big man. He's 6'5", has a big, long stride, but he's very strong. In addition to that, he is the pride of Jamaica. When you fly into the Jamaican airports, Montego Bay, for example, there's a big banner that says, "Welcome to Jamaica, home of Usain Bolt." You know, the world's strongest man. They want you to know, and they're very proud that he's representing their country. But you cannot help but admire them, right, for their natural ability and the hard work that they put in. I don't know how many of you know it, but the Olympics have been around a long time. They had the first Olympiad back in Olympia in Greece about 700 years before Christ. And they've been stopped for a while, but they've picked them up again. And so they've basically been going on for almost 3,000 years, when you think about it. That's pretty amazing. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 23. Paul was not unfamiliar with the Olympiad and the Olympics, and neither was his audience, particularly the two letters that he wrote to the Corinthian church. Now, if you know anything about the geography of Greece, you'll know that Greece is primarily made up of islands and a couple of peninsulas that extend down from the mainland of southern Europe. And Corinth is a port city that is on an isthmus of these two peninsulas. On one peninsula, the smaller peninsula, you have Athens, in the middle of that peninsula, which was the capital of ancient Greece. And we've all heard of Athens, Greece. Beautiful city. We've all heard of its influence, even in the New Testament church. On the other peninsula, a much larger peninsula, in the middle of that peninsula is the town of Olympia. And the Greeks were the ones who started the Olympics. The Romans picked it up. And so it was well known during the time of Paul. And especially in Corinth, being the port city, when the Olympiad started, it was basically representatives from the city-states of the Greeks getting together, their strongest men and women performing. Began with the men and expanded to women later. But at the time of Paul, athletes came from all over the Roman world because it was now a Roman institution, the Olympics were. And when they came to Olympus, they had to come through the port city of Corinth. They would sail to Corinth through the Mediterranean, and they would disembark on the ships, and then they would travel by road down to Olympus, or Olympia, where the Olympics were held. So Paul's audience was very well aware of the same things we saw the past 2 weeks, the Olympics. And he writes this. We find in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 23. 1 Corinthians 9, 23. He was talking about the sacrifices he had made for the sake of the work. And he says, "Now this I do for the gospel's sake, that I may be partaker of it with you." He says, because I want to be in the kingdom with you. So he really kind of sets the stage for what I'm about to read about the Olympics. He says, "Now this I do for the gospel's sake, that I may be partaker of it with you. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize?" And of course, we've seen many athletes receive the gold medal. And of course, all athletes aspire to be on the podium, either gold, silver, or bronze, those top three spots in each of the events. But of course, the big prize is the gold medal winner. And we've all heard of, I guess the U.S. is way ahead in medals this year, primarily because, I don't want to take anything away from our American athletes, but the Russians, 47 Russian athletes were disqualified because of the drugging that has been done for the Russian athletes in the past, a few years especially. But everybody who participates in the Olympics wants to go there with a chance to win gold. That's what he's talking about, the prize. That gold medallion has been around almost as long as the Olympics has. So this was a familiar thing to the Corinthians. But one receives the prize. Run. So he now turns this into a spiritual analogy. Run in such a way that you may obtain it. He's not talking about a gold medal, is he? He's talking about the spiritual Olympics we're involved in. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things, having trained for races in the past. I happen to know that you have to eat a certain diet, and you have to watch what you drink. And I remember several times I went in for physical examinations related to my work. And one of the questions the doctor always asks is, "Do you smoke? How much do you drink and do you smoke?" And of course, I've been able to say, "Well, no, I've never smoked." And invariably, the doctor will say, "Were you an athlete? Were you an athlete in high school or college?" Athletes cannot smoke. And not if they want to perform at a high level, and they have to be very temperate. They can't be heavy drinkers or heavy eaters. It's only that I gained weight after I stopped training, for some of those events that I ran in high school and college. So he says, everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Again, he makes this analogy that the crown that we seek is similar to, but greater than, those that are sought by the Olympians. Therefore, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air. He says, my goal is to win. My goal is to be there. My goal is to get the spiritual gold medal. He says, not as one who beats the air uncertainly. And maybe you've seen some people who are not very athletic running. You ever notice people like that? They have that kind of look about them, the way they run, or they just don't hold their hands right. And you go, boy, that's not an athlete. You can usually tell them, you can look across the park and see them running and say, their strength is probably mathematics. It's not running. You can usually tell when somebody is athletic just by the way they carry themselves and run. And that's what Paul is saying. He says, look, he says, I know. I know what it takes to win this spiritually. Verse 27, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. He says, look, I'm in this race just like you are. Even though I'm a minister, I started the church in Corinth, I'm in this just like everybody else. And I think the analogy is very clear. And I was thinking about the Olympics, of course, this week, and I was thinking about my sermon. And I found it a welcome break, I don't know about you, from the news. The news, a lot of American news is filled with political news, politics, and I wanted a break from that. So I went online and I found an article on MSN, and the title caught my eye. And I tuned into it, and the title was, Four Problems That Could Sink America. Well, that's a captivating title. Good writer. They always pick a good title to their articles. Four Problems That Could Sink America. And I'd like to share these four problems with you, and then I would like to relate them to some of the lessons that we can learn from the Olympics so that we make sure that we personally do not sink, as this article talks about. The four problems that could sink America by this author are, number one, Americans don't like to work. Americans don't like to work. I'll summarize some of the sentences that he had in his article. Kids in Asia spend the summer studying math and science, while American rugrats are texting each other about Brittany and Miley. People need to invest more in their own future. Instead of buying stuff at the mall, spend the money on evening classes. Learn a language or skills you don't have. And he makes a point, and some of the facts that he related was about where America stands now academically. At one point we were number one. Now America has a hard time breaking the top 10 among nations academically. Our children are just not cutting it academically. And our children, the latest generations, are falling behind many other countries when it comes to education. And he says, we just don't like to work. Number two, he said, nobody in America wants to sacrifice. Nobody in America wants to sacrifice. He writes, somehow $19 trillion worth of government debt will just become somebody else's problem. The next generation or the next generation. Politicians plan to get a tiny portion of the American public, the wealthy, to pay higher taxes for the benefit of all the rest of us who don't want to sacrifice or work. Point number three, he mentions, is we're basically uninformed. We're basically uninformed. People who lack the sense to question big lies always end up in deep trouble. If we're too foolish or lazy to educate ourselves on health care, global warming, financial reform, and other complicated issues, then we're signing ourselves over to special interests who will see nothing wrong with plundering our national and personal wealth. Again, I thought the author made some pretty good general points about the status of America. And then number four, he says, we have a big problem with the I culture. The me culture. The I culture. not the we culture anymore, it's the I culture. He says, we may be chastened by our economic problems and our political issues, but Americans still believe they deserve the best of everything. The best job, the best health care, the best education for our kids, and we want it at a big discount, or better yet, we want it free. Which brings us back to the usual disconnect between what we want and what we're willing to pay. I summarized those points in his article, and as I said, it kind of hit a chord with me, and I began to think about it in relationship with the Olympics and the amount of work that goes into that and Paul's comments. And I thought, you know, this might make a very good sermon to talk about these four points and how they spiritually apply to us as God's people. Before I get into the four points and relate them to our spiritual conditions, let's go to Colossians chapter 1. Colossians 1, verse 21. Colossians 1:21, where Paul basically describes the world as it was for us before God called us or before we committed ourselves to God's way of life, since many of us have been raised in the church. He says in verse 21, Colossians 1, and you, who once were alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now he has reconciled through the body of his flesh, through death, to present you holy and blameless and above reproach in his sight. And then he includes in verse 23 the big if indeed you continue in the faith, if we remain grounded, if we are steadfast and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister. There's an expectation that God has for us as we grow spiritually, and that is that we continue to grow spiritually up until God is finished with the product he's trying to produce in us and through us. So my question is, how does a Christian stay grounded and steadfast in a world full of turmoil and instability? How do we stay focused? Well, I believe by addressing these four problems that could contribute to our instability and undermine our future in God's church and even the kingdom of God, we can remain faithful, grounded, and steadfast. Just like those athletes that performed well in the Olympics, there are some very strong analogies. Let's go through these four points that the author talked about the four points that could sink America. Number one, do we like to work? Do we like to work? There, of course, is a very popular notion among the Christian world that once saved, always saved. Once you dedicate your life to God, once you give your heart to the Lord, as they say on radio and television, the evangelists, then you're saved. You know, we go to Africa and we get Africans to just utter the word of Christ and that they accept Christ, then they're saved forever. But is there more to it than that? Well, let's go to Philippians. Philippians, even spiritually, is there more to it than just accepting the sacrifice of Christ? Is there a greater expectation by God? There's been this theological argument of, you know, they call it works versus grace. You know, one or the other. And I think most of us have been around the church long enough, we know the balance between the grace of God, which we all deeply appreciated, and God's forgiveness, and also that God wants us to perform. Philippians 2, verse 12. Philippians 2:12. Paul writes, "Therefore, my beloved, as you have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." A certain level of work is required, just as it is required among athletes. Athletes have to stay in shape, especially an Olympic athlete, don't they? They have to stay sharp. As I mentioned, I ran track in high school and college, and I think I was about 30 years old, serving up in the ministry in Canada, and there was a young man who heard me talk about track and field at one point, and so at a church picnic, he challenged me to a 100-yard dash. And I thought, well, I could take this whippersnapper. You know, I'm still 30. I'm young. I haven't trained a lot, and I haven't, you know, done wind sprints, and I haven't really watched my diet all that well, you know, like I did in training. But I can take this whippersnapper, you know, little 18-year-old kid. So we ran a 100-yard dash, and he beat me, but not by much. And I put the pedal to the metal. I ran as hard as I could. And about 2 hours later, I started breaking out in hives. And I so stressed my body, I broke out in hives. I went to the doctor the next day. They were starting to go away by then. And I said, "Doc, what happened?" And he said, "Well, have you had any physical stress on your body lately?" I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I did something really stupid yesterday." And I told him what I did, responded to this challenge by this 18-year-old kid. And he said, "Well, that does it." He says, "You're not in shape. And you shouldn't have been running against an 18-year-old kid in a 100-yard dash." You know what happens? When you don't work out regularly, what happens? You get out of shape. Even when I was 30 years old, I thought I was in shape. I was playing racquetball regularly and, you know, doing all the things I thought a 30-year-old guy ought to do to stay in shape, but I was out of shape. So much so that when I stressed my body by running 100% in a 100-yard dash, I got hives. It happens, doesn't it? Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. It takes work. We all think we all realize that. Verse 13, "For it is God who works in you with the power of His Spirit, both to will and to do His good pleasure. Do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children to God, without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world." Now tell me, doesn't it take work to sometimes bite your lip? Keep your hands down during episodes of traffic in Southern California? You want to say something sometimes? You want to give a gesture sometimes, right? Of course not. Because you have to work at it, don't you? At work, with your coworkers, don't you sometimes have to bite your lip, bite your tongue, not to say something? Not to react carnally because somebody has been reacting to you carnally? I mean, it takes work, doesn't it? Really, when we consider our spiritual standing, as he says here, that you may become blameless and harmless, the children of God, reflecting God, without fault in the midst of a crooked and a perverse generation. We all know we live in this generation and it's easier to fit in than it is to be outside, which we are when we're the children of God. We're on the outside and there's an expectation that God has of His children, and that is that we stay spiritually in shape. That we're always working to make sure we don't fall down on the job. Verse 16, "Holding fast the word of life, so that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I may not run in vain or labored in vain." We want to make sure that we follow the rules, that we work to please God. You know, I felt sorry in a way for I saw this relay that was run by a number of countries, and of course a relay you have four participants, and you have one man that starts out the race and he passes the baton to the next and the next and the next, and you have the anchor who runs the final leg of the relay. And I believe this team was from Trinidad and Tobago, and they had put together this four-man relay, and they were in the big, this is the Olympics, they'd been training for this for a whole year, working for it, and the man who was leading off, you know, the starter had him get down the blocks, and he said, ready, set, you know, and they all rise up, and they put the toes against the bar, and they're ready for the gun to go off, and this man jumped the gun. He left early, and the horn sounds, and the starter stops everybody, and now with these new electronic sensors on the starting blocks, it's not really a judgment call. The electronics knows who jumped the gun. And the little red light goes on. And in the Olympics, if you jump the gun once, there is no forgiveness. There's no grace. Your team is disqualified. Now, I felt terrible for this team. These men, these four men who had practiced and worked, and they got to the Olympics. And the other three guys weren't at fault at all, but the whole team was disqualified because the starter jumped the gun. Tried to get a little jump on everybody, and of course, electronically, he was caught. The whole team was disqualified. And it was kind of sad. The camera panned around, you just saw these athletes standing there, and their body just, disappointment all over them, and they walked off the track, and the fellow who jumped the gun began to cry. And you can imagine why. How upset could you be? You trained all year, maybe several years, for this moment, this opportunity, and he gets there and he gets disqualified. You know, Paul knew what he was talking about when he said, I work very hard. Verse 16, holding fast the word of life so that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I may not run in vain or labored in vain. He didn't want to be disqualified at the last minute. So a certain measure of work, I think we would all agree, is required of the spiritual Olympiad and the spiritual participant in the spiritual Olympics. Number two. Nobody wants to sacrifice anymore. Have we forgotten that Christianity is about not just work, but sacrifice sometimes? Sometimes required. Let's go to Hebrews 13. Hebrews 13 and verse 15. Hebrews 13, 15. Do we remember that part of our responsibility as Christians and as spiritual Olympians is to sacrifice? Verse 15, therefore by him let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God. You know, I think that Asa hit upon a point that I would like to expand on a bit, and that has to do with our time. You know, our time today is so consumed, isn't it? Not just with work, but, you know, the curse of the smartphone consumes so much time. Every time I go into a restaurant, I look around and nobody's talking to each other anymore. They've got their noses in their smartphones. The other day I saw a family of four come in, you know, preteens in the family, and they're all sitting around the table with their heads in the smartphone. Nobody talks to anybody anymore. It's like we're so distracted. Our time is so consumed with electronics. That's one reason we have the rule at camp. You know, when our teens and preteens go to camp, we say, no smartphones, no Game Boys, no electronics. And, of course, where we have camp, there's no cell signal anyway, so it's helpful. You know, they can't use it for any, but they go, well, we can play games on it, or we can, we say, no, no, there's turn those in. So we have this big baggies we give to every counselor, and the baggies open it up, and the counselors open the baggies up, and the kids have to put in their smartphones and cell phones, and we keep those in the office. A few years ago, I was coordinating a camp up in Connecticut, and it was actually about 20 years ago, because one of the families from New York City, family lived in the Bronx, they came to camp, and as the parents were pulling the luggage out of the trunk for the kid went and opened the back door. I think he was about 13 or 14, and he pulled a television set out of the back of the car. And we looked, and this is back before flat screen televisions, you know. It's a big, bulky television, 20-inch TV, and he's muscling it out of the back seat of the car. And we say, wait a minute, what are you doing with that? He says, well, I like to watch television, and I know I'm coming to camp, but I want to plug this into the dorm so at night we can watch TV. And we go, oh, no, time out. No electronics. That's one of the rules we've had that year, you know, for years and years and years at camp. And so he was very upset with us that he had to put that TV back in the back of mom's car. She had to drive it back to New York and come back and get him at the end of camp and pick him up again. Sometimes our time is just so consumed with our electronics, isn't it? It's taken away. And we don't want to sacrifice any of that precious time, do we? But let's notice Hebrews chapter 13, verse 15. Therefore, by him or through him, let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God. If we spent a fraction of the time praying to God that we spend with our faces in the smartphones, can you imagine how spiritual the church would be? Just think about that for a minute. And we are admonished to sacrifice our time. It's even being compared to like an Old Testament sacrifice of praise to God. That is the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name. Verse 16, but do not forget to do good and to share. What does it take to do good for somebody who's less fortunate? It takes the sacrifice of time or resources, doesn't it? Sometimes people throw money. And I think sacrificing time is even probably more effective, keeps us in better condition than giving money. Do not forget to do good and to share. You know, somebody once called me up and said, Mr. Register, I hate to put you out, but would you do this for me? And I go, that's why I'm here, is to be put out. That kind of surprised them. I said, that's why I'm here, is to be put out. I'd finally gotten to the point where there were people who would call me that knew me very well or that I knew them, and they'd say, well, I hope you're not busy right now. And I would say, no, I'm just sitting here next to the phone hoping somebody would call. We're always doing something, right? We're always occupied with something. We're always busy with something. But when someone calls and someone needs help or assistance, that's why we're here, isn't it? To be put out. Do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices, God is well pleased. God expects us to sacrifice our time and resources. On occasion, you have to balance that, as we heard in the sermonette, with, you know, sleep and work and other things. But sacrifice is important for the Christian. When all of us counsel for baptism, the minister probably read Luke 14, verses 26 and 27. Luke 14, 26 and 27. And he said, Christ did, you must be willing to give up. Remember that? Husband, wife, child, parents, and even your own life. You see, the basis of Christianity is sacrifice, isn't it? The willingness to do that if we have to. And it is interesting that those early disciples of Christ all gave up their lives in martyrdom. They paid the ultimate sacrifice, just as Christ, our example, did. Number two, nobody wants to sacrifice. Well, hopefully we do, and we're willing to sacrifice. Point number three, the author of that article said we're uninformed, and Americans really are uninformed. When I lived in Canada, I remember driving into a gas station in California many, many years ago, and I was getting gas, and there was a guy next to me there, and he said, "I see you have British Columbia plates on your car." I said, "Yeah, I'm from Canada." He says, "Oh, do you know my cousin? He lives in Toronto." He was totally ignorant about the geography of Canada, our neighbors next door. Toronto, in case you don't know, is about 3,000 miles from British Columbia. And Toronto is about half the size of New York City. You know, it has nearly 10 million people in it. It's huge. How in the world could I know his cousin? But he was very sincere. He said, "Oh, do you know my cousin? He lives in Toronto." Basically, Americans, we listen to American news. We're very domestic in our approach. We don't know much about the world compared to the rest of the world. Linda's relatives in Japan know a lot more about America than any of us know about Japan. And I discovered that when I started visiting Japan and hearing them talk about America. And I said, they know a lot more about America and our politics and our laws and our Constitution than we do. And yet we Americans, we know very little about Japan, the Japanese, in Asia. We're basically uninformed, but I think sometimes we're uninformed spiritually. Let's go to Luke chapter 21. Luke 21 and verse 34. I think, again, some of these trends that we find in the world spill over into the church. Luke 21, 34. Christ said, "Take heed to yourselves," Luke 21, 34, "lest your hearts be weighted down with carousing, drunkenness, the cares of this life, and that day come upon you unexpectedly." It is so easy to get caught up in our day-to-day world, where we live, Northern and Central California, that we think this is the world. And yet it's not. There's a big world out there, physically and spiritually. Verse 35, "For it will come as a snare to all those who dwell on the face of the entire earth, the end of the world and the judgment that will come with it." Verse 36, we read this scripture many times, but what does it really mean? Watch, therefore. It doesn't especially mean watch CNN or Fox News. Watch is a spiritual term. It means to be spiritually aware. Are we spiritually aware of what's going on in the world around us? "Watch, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things," and he went through the Olivet prophecy in the previous verses, "that will come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man." So when he uses this term watch, he's talking about being spiritually on guard and watching. In fact, there's an interesting companion scripture over in Matthew 26 and verse 36, Matthew 26:36, where this is illustrated, I think, by Christ, and he uses the opportunity to teach this principle, Matthew 26:36, that we need to be aware. "Then Jesus came to them and to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, 'Sit here while I go and pray out over there.'" Now, Gethsemane is it's called the Garden of Gethsemane, but it's basically an orchard of olive trees. And if you've ever been in an olive orchard, you know there's nice soft grass under the olive trees because olives need water. And so they were resting and reclining there. This is the night Christ is going to be betrayed. And he says, why don't you guys just relax and rest here for a while? I'm going to go over there and pray. And there are a lot of little valleys there were then, during the first century, in this large valley called the Kidron Valley, where the Garden of Gethsemane is. And he was going to go a little ways away and pray. Verse 37 says, he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. And he said to them, my soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to the point of death. Stay here and watch with me. The same word, watch. Stay here and watch with me. He says, I want you to be spiritually on guard, because this night spiritual forces are going to bring about the betrayal of the Son of God. Be spiritually watchful. And he went a little farther and fell on his face and he prayed, O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, what? Could you not watch with me for 1 hour? Couldn't you stay spiritually alert for an hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. So Christ uses this moment to teach a spiritual principle that is preserved for us. Watch, that is, be aware of what's going on around us spiritually, and pray, lest you enter into temptation. What has happened among the churches of God? You know, some people have asked me, why didn't more people come with Church of God or Worldwide Association? And my experience has told me that some people don't want to know what happened. They want to be blissfully uninformed. In fact, they've told me that. I'm comfortable in my social situation. I've got all my friends here. Don't bother me with the facts. Maybe some of you have heard that. I'm not going to ask any questions because I don't want to hear your answers. Basically, they want to stay spiritually uninformed because they're very comfortable, thank you, where they are. Watch and pray, Christ said, lest you enter into temptation. Spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. We are all drawn by our carnal natures, aren't we? But we must be spiritually aware. Spiritually aware of what's going on in the world around us. Spiritually aware of what's happening politically. And knowing that behind the political scenes there are high-ranking spirits that are arguing and fighting and pulling and contending for power. We need to be aware of that. We need to be aware of what's going on in the church. We need to question. We need to ask questions constantly. Not just assume. Watch and pray. Be spiritually aware lest you enter into temptation. Point number four is the I culture. The I culture, or the me culture. That is, what's in it for me? What's in it for me attitude. Spiritually, I come to church for what I can get out of it. Some people say, I am involved for the takeaway for me. Do we remember the story of the two trees? Has it been that long ago? Can't remember. The way of get, the way of give. Are we in God's church for what we can give to others, or are we here because of what we can get? Let's go to Mark chapter 10, Mark 10, verse 35. Mark 10, 35 describes a discussion that the sons of Zebedee, James and John, had with Christ. It says, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him, saying, Teacher, we want you to do something for us. And Christ said, Well, what do you want me to do for you? In verse 37, and they said to him, Grant us that we may sit one on your right hand and the other on your left in your glory. They had heard his prophecies. They had heard his parables. They knew that his kingdom was coming. They didn't want to take his place. All they wanted was to be on his right or his left. That means number two or number three. They said, we don't want the gold medal. We want the silver and the bronze. And the other disciples, you know, they can sit at the end of the table. But this is what we want. Their relationship with the Son of God was based on what we can get out of it. A very carnal response, wouldn't you agree? Very carnal. Looking out for number one here. What can I get out of it? And Jesus said to them in verse 38, You do not know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink and be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? He knew he was going to be betrayed. He knew he was going to lose his life. He knew he was going to be beaten. He knew he was going to be rejected even by his own. And they said to him, Oh yeah, we can do it. We're able. Like when most of us are baptized. Oh yeah, I can commit. And after two or three years, we go, Whoa, this is tough. This is work. This requires sacrifice. I've got to constantly be spiritually aware. Verse 37, Jesus said to them, You will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism I am baptized with, you will be baptized. What happened to these two disciples? Like Christ, they were martyred. Verse 40, But to sit at my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared. And then when the ten heard it, they began to be greatly displeased with James and John. They were not happy. And this caused a little internal strife between the disciples. You know the story. So when we think about our Olympic journey spiritually, I think we need to remember that we should want to work, because we realize this calling takes a lot of work. Number two, we should want to sacrifice, because we realize our calling takes a certain measure of sacrifice. Number three, we should be informed and aware spiritually, always watching and aware. And number four, we should be a part of the we culture, not the I culture. So just as sure as these characteristics will bring our nation to failure, we must be on guard against these current cultural trends that could bring about our failure spiritually. Let's take a lesson from the Olympics. The Olympic champion must train. He must work. He must sacrifice. He must be informed. And he has to think like a team member. Not selfishly. When we do that, we can indeed be spiritual Olympic champions and get, as Paul admonished us, the gold prize at the end, that is eternal life.